CBSSports.com. Again, it's now Sunday, February 1st. Welcome to February, everybody. And this is, of course, the Eye on College Basketball Podcast brought to you by Squarespace, which has launched a version of its platform called Squarespace 7, which has a completely redesigned interface, integrations with Getty Images and Google Apps, 15 new templates, and a feature called Cover Pages. If you want to try the new Squarespace, go to squarespace.com and enter the offer code FUN at checkout to get 10% off that Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere. I'm joined for this episode by Matt Norlander and Sam Vecenia. And let's start with the biggest game of the weekend, which was Duke's crazy come from behind win at Virginia. Blue Devils are now 18-3 overall. Virginia's now 19-1. It means that Kentucky is the nation's only undefeated team. And who bounces back better than Duke? Lost to Miami earlier this year. Next game, win at Louisville. Lost at Notre Dame this past Wednesday. Next game, win at Virginia, even though Duke was a 6-point underdog in the game. And who needs Rashid Suleiman? Pretty impressive, right, Norlander?
Okay, guys, let's rewind to our podcast from just a few days ago when we basically gave Duke almost, you know, no chance at winning this game.
Let's actually rewind.
Yeah, let's do it.
But no, I can't do that right now. But here's, I think I remember this. I think I remember saying this. They've already won at Wisconsin. They've already won at Louisville.
Yeah, yeah.
I won't pick them to win, but it won't surprise me if they do.
Yeah, yeah. There was some qualification going on
there.
But I think it's fair. Avid listeners of the podcast would have surmised that the three of us felt as though Virginia would win this game with a little bit of comfort, because there was little reason to believe that Duke was gonna pull it off. And you know what? The thing is, like, Duke gets the win, and they do it with a flurry of offense and great shooting in the final few minutes. But otherwise, you know, Virginia very much played the game it wanted to play. But this doesn't happen often to Virginia. In fact, that was one of the, I guess, most successful shooting percentage performances by points per possession any team's had against the Tony Bennett coached Virginia team ever. But if you play the way that Virginia does, that's the one thing where you remain vulnerable, because, you know, Tony's system, for as successful as it can be, if you tend with that pack line defense to get into games where you're winning 62-55, it doesn't happen often, but if you play a team like Duke that can get hot and they can just bury three or four three-pointers down the stretch, you're going to get stung, and that's what happened here. And by the way, that Tyus Jones three that sealed it,
woo,
was like the ultimate no, 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 oh my God, it went in. That ball game. Like, that was so ice,
yep.
That was so nails, it was an awesome moment.
Yeah, I mean, Sam, you were watching the game, I'm certain. It felt like, forget how did that happen, because that's what everybody was saying after the game, or tweeting after the game, like, what just happened? Whoa, what a performance from Duke. It felt like Virginia probably walked off that court going, what in the world just happened? I mean, I don't know what listeners would have concluded from the podcast on Friday. I didn't think that Virginia would just go in and win comfortably. I mean, again, like, that's a Duke team that I had ranked in the top five even before yesterday. I thought it'd be a competitive game. Wouldn't surprise me if Virginia won comfortably, but the outcome didn't surprise me either. But the way it happened was surprising. I mean, when you go down double digits on the road to, you know, the number two team in the country, you're probably, you know, in the final minutes, you're supposed to lose that game. And then, like, I felt like Virginia must have walked off that court. Tony must have walked off that court going, what? Hold up. What just happened? Because we were in control. We were, you know, the fans were celebrating. I'll tell you this. I start sometimes working on the top 25 and one, like, throughout the day, just sort of, you know, projecting, okay, this team's going to win, this team's going to lose. Go ahead and do just small stuff, like change the record, start looking at bodies of work. Mm-hmm. I had already changed Duke to a loss and Virginia to a win. And, yeah, you know, just sort of working ahead. Like, I'm watching the game in my hotel in St. Louis, and I'm like, okay, this is the way this is going to go down. Now, what do I do with Duke? Virginia stays number two. What do I do with Duke? I was sort of thinking in those terms. And then, you know, it's a Quinn Cook three, it's a Tyus Jones three, and then the buzzer sounds. I mean, don't you think, Sam, like, Virginia probably was a little, I don't know if shell-shock's the right term, but something. Like, that was a weird final few minutes.
No, seriously. Like, I think that Duke did something that has never happened under a Tony Bennett coach team at Virginia and probably will never happen again. They scored on 14 of their final 15 possessions,
right,
and scored 35 points on,
wow,
those 15 possessions. Like, that's something that I honestly do not think will ever happen again to a Tony Bennett coach team. Like, it's just that much of an outlier, that much of a phenomenal Duke shooting performance. And a lot of it was, hey, like, Duke got a lot of layups, like, right at the rim. They got more penetration on that pack line defense than probably anyone else has this year. And that's absolutely a credit to Duke, to Coach K, who really changed the momentum of that game by he kept switching up defenses every time that Virginia was down the floor. He had some in the 3-2 zone. He had some in the 2-3 zone. He went man a couple possessions. Like he really changed the complexion and changed the way that game was going for Duke by keeping their defenses switched up and keeping Virginia on their toes on offense. And their defense led to some offense down the road. But at the same time, I can't help but think that some of this is just a fluky thing that happened to.
Oh, I think it very much was like
a
I,
team.
Like,
yeah, no, like look, all I credit think, to Duke, right. But like it's just like a weird phenomenon that I don't think will, like I said, ever happen again under Tony Bennett.
No, but it was fluky, and it doesn't mean that Duke isn't awesome or that Duke didn't deserve the win. But like, Duke, you can be awesome and be terrific and be down double digits in the second half at Virginia and still lose. I mean, like the way they were able to erase that deficit and then, you know, win, I guess it was by two possessions was I think among the most impressive things we've seen, you know, in the entire season this year. I mean, I know Kentucky's had those games where they run Kansas off the court, run UCLA off the court. Hell, they run almost everybody off the court. But the last whatever minutes of 10 minutes of that Duke-Virginia game were awesome. And is it just a reminder on some level, Norlander, that you can take a Rashid Suleiman off or any sort of piece off and you can drop them down to 8 scholarship players or whatever it is now? But as long as you've got a Hall of Fame coach and 3 first round draft picks, like you still got a shot to do whatever it is you wanted to do.
Yeah, I'll kind of echo what I said last week in that. Yeah, no, definitely Duke is certainly still capable of winning the title. I wouldn't count him out of that. I would still this win was huge. I still think there is a grand effect, a minimal one, but still there that they won't have Suleiman over the course of the next, you know, 15 games or so, however many they're going to end up playing. But yeah, when you look at what the guys Duke is putting on the floor in a game-by-game basis, they're absolutely capable of beating anyone, and I would absolutely include Kentucky in that. I would still love to see this Duke team play Kentucky, if that's at all possible down the road. The loss at least makes it interesting from an ACC race perspective because Virginia not only loses its first game of the season, first conference game, but they drop it at home. So, you know, you think the Cavs are going to get picked off at least once on the road, maybe even twice. And with North Carolina getting picked off, and I don't know if we're going to get to that, I assume we will, the way that they just blew it against Louisville, those two teams and Notre Dame all have 2 losses. Duke has 3 and is kind of in the hunt, but it might be too tough, I feel, for them to get it. But at least the ACC isn't a guarantee. I would still think Virginia's going to take it, but that was for the Virginia Cavaliers to have fallen on their home floor that way, we'll have at least a little bit of intrigue. And now, if Duke is able to rally and get a few more big wins, we actually could come to a situation, if the Blue Devils won the ACC tournament, where we'd be debating which ACC team should get 1 seeds. And we'll see how the rest of the field plays out. But, you know, would Virginia and a Duke both be up for a 1 seed at that point? So at least it's a little interesting.
Well, if we were doing the bracket right now, they'd both be in consideration for 1. Like Virginia would obviously get 1, and I think you could make a really solid argument for Duke as well. I mean, you'd be talking Kentucky automatically gets 1, Virginia automatically gets 1. I think Gonzaga probably does. You could debate that. I know people would, but I think Gonzaga probably would. And then, like, what else? Who else are we talking about?
Wisconsin.
I think you could give it to Wisconsin because you could say they got 1 bad loss and Kaminsky didn't play. Like, you could sort of, if you wanted to, you know, put an asterisk on that, you could. And so, but yeah, I think, like, right now, Duke's in play for a 1 seed. And so, do they have a chance to get there? Of course they do. And if the ACC gets, you know, the idea that the ACC might get 2 ones, that would make a whole lot of sense to me. There's a lot of power.
And if Notre Dame had not have lost at Pittsburgh, they would absolutely be in that conversation now as well, because they'd only have 2 losses to, you know, Virginia, and it would have been Providence on a neutral, and the Friars are bound for the tournament at this point.
Yeah, Providence on a neutral by a point, and then to Virginia, was that an overtime game?
It was a close game,
right? And then, I mean, the Notre Dame thing, that's just your classic letdown, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Except you know, Pitt's all, you know, I know Pitt's not good this year, but they're still like
it's a hard
place to win. But
it
like,
is a hard place to win.
Do you see their record against top 10 teams all time in that building? It's like 14.
It's wild.
It's like 14-3 or some, or maybe like a yeah. I mean, it's like top 10 teams lose there all the time. So I think it was a little surprising given what Louisville had just done to Pitt in that building, but still. Yes. It wasn't that surprising because you combine letdown with, you know, Peterson Events Center and you get what you get. Let's go back to the state of Virginia for a second. Sad news yesterday. VCU's Briante Weber suffered a torn ACL and MCL. He's a senior. His college career is now done. Just awful news. He loses the opportunity to break the NCAA's record, Division I record for steals, and he would have broken it. He was only 12 away. He had 6 yesterday before he got hurt. So, like, he could have theoretically broken it in the next, you know, 2 or 3 games. Now he never will. Also, it means VCU's down a key player, arguably the most important player from a team that I think was Final Four capable. It's tough to think of another career-ending injury that hurts on multiple levels like this. Kenyon Martin's is an obvious one at Cincinnati when that team was going to be the number 1 overall seed and the favorite to win a national championship. I mean, Hugs probably has a national championship right now if Kenyon Martin doesn't break his leg at the Pyramid. And, you know, Kendall Marshall a few years ago, obviously they would have been probably the biggest threat to Kentucky in 2012 if he doesn't suffer that wrist-hand injury. But this one's just, it's just, I hate to throw around terms like this because it can sound sort of silly, but like it really is heartbreaking. You know, like that's a college career done, an opportunity to set an NCAA record gone. And given the fact that Bree isn't an obvious NBA player, like he can get there, maybe, but yeah. You know, there's certainly no guarantees. In fact, the odds are probably stacked against him for a variety of reasons. It is possible that he has played his last relevant basketball game in this country. You know, like he could be in the D League or go overseas, but he's played his last relevant basketball game in this country, maybe. And to have that happen so abruptly, I just, you know, yeah, I talked to the VCU staff last night and they said he was, you know, he was reacting to the news about the way you would expect somebody whose career was abruptly finished would. And so, like, just sad to hear, right, Norlander?
Yeah, so very sad. Like, to me, it was a given he was going to pass it. You didn't assume that Bree would go out this way. He is what's been intriguing to me about Briante Weber is that, and basically, steel specialists are players that I'm always fascinated by because it's one of the top things that every scouting report. It's just one of those obvious things coaches pick up on, warn their players about. But the guys that really can do it, you just cannot stop them. They are going to get their swipes, and it's going to happen no matter how much you try and avoid against it. And Weber, who has been a premier all-around defender, in my opinion, I mean, he's been good in the full court, man-on-man, getting into the lanes. To me, his nose for the ball in many different defensive facets are the reason why he's even, you know, debated as an NBA player at this point, because he is that smart on that end of the floor, and he has gotten better. I mean, his season's done, so barring any sort of ridiculous defensive performance from a top 5 guy, which isn't going to happen, he'll have played at VCU for 4 years and led the nation not only in steals but actually in steals percentage. So, and this was his best year. I mean, 8.7% of possessions he was in on, he was stealing the ball away from his opponents, which is ridiculous. And, you know, more than 2 possession points higher than he was last year. Definitely heartbreaking. And then big picture, I mean, I don't know how high or not high Sam was relatively on the Rams, but, I mean, Trevion Graham is certainly in the running for A-10 Player of the Year. And maybe overall he's their most important player, but Briante was certainly a lot of that heart and soul. So I would not consider VCU Final Four worthy now. I think if with this kind of situation, making the Sweet 16, even though that locker room will have those expectations from our kind of national perch and maybe fans' perch, if you don't have Briante, such a big part of that defensive identity, get to the second weekend, it turns into a successful year.
Yeah, you know, I was at VCU back in November, and, you know, I went to a practice. It was after they beat Tennessee at the Naval Academy. And before they were getting ready to play, I don't know, somebody. And so I was there, and it was a Sunday afternoon practice. And, Shaka actually asked me to, like, speak to the team. So I spoke to the team. And a lot of the stuff we talked about was I had told a story about Tony Allen to Shaka just, like, at dinner the night before. We were talking about Tony Allen, and, you know, we were talking about the Grizzlies because of where I live. And sort of as the story goes, it was like, you know, like Tony Allen, one time I was at a Grizzlies game earlier this year, and they were playing New Orleans. And Eric Gordon, you know, he plays for New Orleans, and Tony was just consumed with Eric Gordon. Like, he would walk over to us because we sit, you know, I sit right on, you know, press row, right on the court. And I got a stats monitor right in front of me. And I'm right by the Grizzlies bench. And he would walk over to me, like, every other timeout. And be like, what's Eric Gordon? 1 of 8? I'd be like, yeah. He goes, okay. What is he now from three? You know, he just kept, he was keeping track in his head and then kind of wanted to confirm what he was keeping track. Meantime, he's actually getting a double-double. Tony is, like, you know, 12 points, 11 rebounds, something like that. After the game, he had no idea he had a double-double. He had no idea what his numbers were, but he knew Eric Gordon's exactly. And I was like, why are you so consumed with Eric Gordon? And he was like, I don't know. I was just like, and I went and looked it up. Like, Eric Gordon had really got off on him one game last year, and he's never forgot about that. And the point I was sort of making is that, you know, this is a guy who, I don't know if anybody understands their identity in the NBA better than Tony Allen. Like, he's not there. You know, he actually, you know, said one time, he said, listen, I would love to take 15 shots a game. Nobody's going to pay me $5 million to do that. You know, I'd love to be the primary option or even an option on offense for an NBA team. But nobody's going to pay me to do that. The only thing they pay me to do is shut down perimeter guys. And so that's all I care about. That's all I try to do. And if I can get a backdoor cut layup every once in a while, that's fine too. And so Shaka was like, talk to my guys about that. Tell them that story. Because they all think they're going to the NBA. And none of them are as good as Tony Allen was even in college. And
who was ridiculous in college.
That's the other thing people don't remember. He was the Big 12 player of the year. Like, he was awesome in college. And so Shaka just sort of wanted me to, like, tell the, you know, sort of explain to these guys that this is a guy who is the Big 12 player of the year, and he is basically not allowed to shoot on his NBA team. But he makes $5 million a year strictly because of what he could do in one very specific area. And so it was Briante that really was into this conversation. And oddly, and I'm not sure why, Bree told me he's actually a Grizzlies fan. And so he was really interested in this Tony Allen story and how it all went down. And it's one of the things that they had tried to hammer into him. Like, stop, you're never going to make it to the NBA because of the way you shoot or because of the way you dribble or because of the way you do anything other than the way you can guard. If you get there, it'll be that. So try to be the best you can be at that. And don't even worry about the other stuff really that much, because that other stuff ain't going to matter anyway. If you can do this one thing really well, then there's somebody will pay you to do it. And so I just always remember him being really, not obsessed, but really interested in that Tony Allen story. And he had gone out this year and been as good as he could possibly be defensively, maybe the best defensive player in the country, probably the best perimeter defender in the country. He was doing all of the things that you'd like to see a young prospect do if the goal is to try to make money doing this. And just for it to all come apart randomly on a Saturday afternoon, it was just a shit. Like, when I first saw it on Twitter, because I was at the St. Louis UMass game, it was like, Briante's down, doesn't look good. I was like, ah, shit. And then, like, you know, I get the text message last night, tore everything. It's like not just a season-ending knee injury. I mean, it is wrecked his entire knee. Sam, let me ask you, does he have a pro future? Was he even on people's radar?
Yeah, I mean, he was definitely on my radar. I had him at number 83. I just published my, like, literally right as we went live on this podcast, I published my big board, and he's still listed on there because I finalized it on Friday, but I'll probably drop him off just because I don't know what to do, like, as far as his knee. Like, I'm not a doctor, and you would think that that's going to affect his quickness and athleticism, like, going forward. Like, he's probably not going to be able to do draft workouts.
He definitely won't be able to do draft workouts. Yeah.
So, I mean, he's going to fall off my top 100. He'll probably go to the D League next year, you would think, assuming that, like, everything works out. But the injury just sucks. If you guys remember, at the beginning of the season, I did all defensive teams for CBSSports.com, like preseason all defensive teams. He was my defensive player of the year preseason, and he was, like, he's outperformed what I expected of him even. Like it's just he's an incredible defender. He's incredibly, there are few players in like the like, I don't want to say the history of college basketball, but like in the last decade that I've like really, really, really watched college basketball, he is probably like in my top five players just to watch, just because of like how fun he is to watch on the floor. He's so intense. He is just so into the game. He's so into defending people.
To cut you off, Sam, but I would just say he is the model player that, you know, that embodies what their Havoc scheme is about.
Yep.
And I think that staff would tell you if they're even able to get someone that's 80% of what Briante is capable of, and, you know, physically and mentally in terms of approach, they'd be forever grateful because I think he is the absolute perfect fit for that system.
Remember, today's Eye on College Basketball podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, where you can easily create your own professional website or online portfolio. Squarespace is now redesigned with Squarespace 7 interface, including integration with Google Apps, partnership with Getty Images, 15 new templates and cover pages, and Squarespace has an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Everything starts just $8 a month. It includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year, and every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content's going to look great on every device every time. You want to start a free trial, no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com, enter the offer code FUN at checkout to get 10% off and to show your support for the Eye on College Basketball podcast. At Squarespace, start here, go anywhere. Let's do some news and notes presented by Squarespace. And let's start with an interesting scene in Gainesville yesterday. Just a wild press conference where Arkansas coach Mike Anderson like went in, not just on officiating, but like on a specific official, like by name. It was all rooted in this controversial call, you know, in the final seconds. First off, let me ask, because I don't know. You guys both saw the foul?
I saw the call. I didn't see the foul.
Oh, that's what I mean. You saw the call. We all agree, like, there was no foul, right?
No foul. That was brutal. I mean, that was...
It was brutal. It wasn't just a bad call. It was a bad call that literally cost Arkansas a road win. I mean, like, I know people love to say, and I'll never understand why people say this, by the way. People will say, well, you know, that one play didn't cost anybody the game. There's a lot of plays in the game. Well, sometimes, yeah, one thing actually can cost you a game. You know, like yesterday, like that call cost them the game because like you call it the right way, which is a no call. Then the buzzer sounds and the game is over and Arkansas leaves with a 1-point win. Instead, they leave with a 1-point loss. And so when people say, well, you know, it's never just one call that can cost you the game. Sometimes it absolutely is. Or it's never just one shot that, you know, costs you. Sometimes it is. And that one call costs them the game. Still, you rarely see head coaches go in on officials as specifically and directly as Mike did. But you know what? Like, I can't even blame him. At some point, like, you just gotta, particularly if you think you got a bad whistle all day. And I didn't watch the game because I was, you know, I was otherwise occupied. But my understanding is Mike felt like they got a bad whistle the whole game. But you know, when something like that happens and it's just an awful call that literally cost you a win on the road in a time where you're under pressure to get to the NCAA tournament and perform in it, I don't have any issue with Mike going in. And though, you know, he will be disciplined in some way by the SEC office, that official should be disciplined in some way too, because he changed the outcome of a game. Am I wrong here?
Yeah, no, this is a... Well, one, Florida was only called for 11 team fouls, so this, you know, that was the final, the fact that this came at the end, it was a bad call. The game, it wasn't brutal. Like, whereas, like, in the Carolina-Louisville game, Carolina fans really felt like they were getting hosed, and they might have had a little bit of case there because the foul discrepancy was so huge. In this one, it was just 18-11. But that final play was the wrong call. One, as a media member, I'm always more than happy when a coach is willing to say something like this after a game just because it makes good copy. But overall, generally speaking, I feel like college basketball officials aren't too headstrong. Sometimes there are certain guys that have developed those reputations, and rightfully so. And I like when a coach just does not have fear of any sort of retribution or fine. You know, for all we know, Mike Anderson is maybe some booster. We'll do him a solid on the side and essentially pay him back one way or another down the road.
Yeah, but he's a multimillionaire with a brand new contract.
Yeah, like, whatever.
He's fine.
Yeah, exactly. So you know what? Like when you get wronged, like freaking call the guys out. I'm totally for this. Officials, yeah, they get flack from fans, but that's to be expected. It's baked into the culture of the sport and all sports. But there are certainly times when the wrong calls are made. And I'm telling you, if officials simply just weren't afraid to just quickly own up to it and say they were wrong, if you don't have repeat violations of this kind of stuff that really affects your job, then it's better for everyone. But until we get that kind of stuff, yeah, anytime a coach wants to call a guy out for making the wrong call, I'm all for it. And that was a brutal call. That's the difference. Like Arkansas is still on track to make the tournament. I think they will. But if they win that game yesterday, it's a quality road win that essentially buries Florida's hopes and kind of firmly puts the Hogs at 2 in the SEC overall. They're still okay, but that was clearly, like, when you're dying for road wins of quality in conference play and you have one, it's ripped from you, yeah, you're going
to
be pissed.
Right, for a program that struggled on the road as much as they've struggled on the road under Mike, to be in a position where you're getting that win, beyond that, it enhances your tournament resume in a significant way. Beyond that, and you know, I know some people don't care about this stuff, but I have forever believed that it matters, if only because you show up on the tickers on different networks. But, like, it cost them a place in the top 25, too. Like, they would have been in the top 25 on Monday. And so, I have no issue with a coach. You know, if a coach just wants to bitch about, we got a bad – like, I don't need to hear that. But when it's something very specific – that literally cost you a game, go in on the guy if you want to. And, you know, to your point about officials, like, admitting a mistake, like, that's the way this one ought to go down. They ought to just come back and say, like, clearly it wasn't a foul, but, you know, it's a human error, and we're going to have that. You know, we're going to have that in basketball. It's unfortunate that it happened. Just sort of own up to it. I mean, at this point, you know, we have HD televisions. Like, we can tell it's not a foul. I have actually heard, and I thought this was neat, sitting courtside at games, I've actually heard officials tell coaches before, like, I missed it. You know, like... and I'm always impressed by that, and it basically takes all the bullets out of the coach's gun. Like, the coach is firing at you, like, how did you not make that call, you blah blah blah, and the coach is going in, and the ref walks over and goes, hey, I missed it. What do you want me to say? And then it's over with. Like, okay, you missed it. At least you're owning up to it. I think I know I can respect that. I think most coaches can, but I don't know. Like, I'm not the guy who gets furious about, you know, the lack of quality officiating in college basketball, but that was a bad moment, and a bad moment that mattered in a very real way. Sam, Utah bounced back from its awful performance that you witnessed at UCLA the other night with a 67-39 win at USC. And so now USC, like, we've talked about Utah enough, whatever. But I'm interested in your thoughts. You live in LA. USC's now 1-8 in the Pac-12. They are lower at KenPom than USC upstate. In other words, USC is ranked...
All right, good factoid here.
USC is ranked lower than USC upstate. And so, like, I'm a Andy Enfield believer. Like, I thought that was a great hire. I didn't think it was a knee-jerk reaction to some magical run. I thought the magical run made people look at Andy's resume. And when you look at his resume, you go, wow, there's some really interesting stuff here. It made as much sense as anything else USC could do. But it's undeniably not going well. Like, how does this thing end up? Is Andy Enfield coaching USC 2 years from now?
Oh, I think it's going to depend a lot on... I mean, they're, first off, they're a really young team.
Sure. This,
like, they are, like, freshmen and sophomores, and then Caton Reinhart, who is a transfer in from UNLV, who's a little bit older. But yeah, it's a really young team. I think it's just going to depend on the way that their freshmen come in next year. I think that next year is going to be the year where they need to show some progress. Like, that... You're going to have your own guys in there if you're Andy Enfield. You're going to have some juniors, at least, that are pretty strong. You're going to have Jordan McLaughlin, who will, like, be your – I don't know if he'll be a star, but he'll be your guy, at least. So I think that next year is going to be the year where he has to start showing some improvement. I mean, I'll say this. Like, the feel around Los Angeles is that, like, even though UCLA sucks, it's still, like, the – UCLA is still the team in – Los Angeles, like, no one talks about USC at all. Like, you would think that this season could have been a pretty good opportunity for USC to make a mark and really stamp their foot in like the Los Angeles area, because Andy Enfield bought, like, some sort of billboard, didn't he, whenever he first got this job, about, like, how he wanted to take back Los Angeles hoops.
Oh, he did all sorts of things. And
That was before I lived here, even. Like, whenever he first got this job, he got this job, and then I moved in, like, probably a few months later.
Sam, do you remember when Enfield said that thing kind of just off color at a practice and some reporter was there and kind of took liberty with it? Remember that, GP?
Well, there was
like, we don't play like that at UCLA.
Well, he's done a few of those. Like he basically pissed off everybody. Like the first one he said is like, they're in practice and you know, they're getting up and down and the kids aren't running, you know, they're not running. And so, he yells at some point, we don't jog here. If you want to walk and jog, go play at UCLA. That's what they do. We play fast here. And so, of course, that, you know, that was a practice moment that all coaches have. And like some reporter who didn't understand that,
right?
You know, that, like, dude, I've sat in on so many John Calipari practices. Like if I started writing every word that it was mumbled or yelled, like John would have been fired like 50 times by now. Like, you know, that's the way coaches talk, right? And it's the way coaches motivate. And so, yeah, that was a reporter mistake more than an Andy Enfield mistake. But then he also at a booster club meeting or some sort of function, he was talking about Tim Floyd.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Floyd. That was in Hawaii. I think it was wasn't that the Diamond Head Classic in Hawaii, maybe?
It was before that, but then they were out. USC and UTEP were both in that event.
There we go.
And they got face-to-face there, and, like, Floyd confronted him, like, at a dinner, like, at a pre-tournament dinner. Like, Floyd, like, you know, they exchanged words. But the thing there was basically – and keep in mind, this, like, everything Andy Enfield says has kind of been true. It's just not stuff that you expect to read that a coach has said publicly, because he really didn't say him publicly. But, like, about Tim, he was like, you know, yeah, Tim Floyd – you know, he was trying to get this job. You know, he wanted this job. And you know, because, and he's just, somebody asked, like, why is Tim Floyd pissed off at him or something? He was like, well, Tim wanted this job, you know? And so now he's mad he has to live in El Paso for another year or two.
That's right. And then Floyd was all, nobody talks about El Paso.
Nobody talks about El Paso like that. Yeah, right. It's so funny. Like, Enfield must have just, on some level, been like, what in the world is happening? Like, I'm saying all these things, like, to my buddies and to my players. I didn't think this stuff was going to get out. Like, you know, yeah. So anyway, those were funny stories. I'd be interested if he. I've always thought, at least always thought in recent years, like that USC program can be good. Like Tim had it going, and then it, you know, it fell apart for, you know, NCAA reasons.
Yeah,
but
he had it going. Yes,
had it going, and then it fell apart, and here we are. But I mean, the Gaylen Center is Sam. I'm assuming you've been there, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah,
it's beautiful.
So, it's a really nice arena.
Really nice college basketball arena. It's USC. It's Southern California. Like, there's no reason you – like, people will say, well, you can't be good at USC, and that is speaking from a historical perspective. But, like, from all the stuff that actually matters in the year 2015 perspective, like, there's no reason you can't be good at USC. And so I think it'd be good for the Pac-12 and good for college basketball in general if that school were relevant, if Andy were relevant again. But, again, not going so well right now. The 60 – basically a 30-point loss to Utah on Sunday afternoon. Let's wrap up with this. Monday night's got a couple of interesting games. Virginia at North Carolina is one of them. We talked about Virginia earlier. Both these teams now coming off a loss. It's going to be a coin flip game, even though it is played in Chapel Hill. I suspect the point spread will be, you know, a point either way, but it'll basically be a coin flip game. The other one, of course, is Iowa State at Kansas. These two teams played on a Saturday night a few weeks ago, and Iowa State, of course, pulled away late and won. But is this the revenge game? I mean, it should be an unbelievable atmosphere at Allen Fieldhouse, and I suspect Kansas probably wins a close one. That makes the most sense, right, Norlander?
Yes, I think Kansas will win. Give me Kansas kind of somewhat comfortably, like 8 to 10 points. And if and when that happens, I mean, Kansas is going to be 8-1. I mean, West Virginia's done a great job, and perhaps on a future podcast we'll really give Huggins his due with this team that only has 3 losses. But that's basically going to be the only hopeful, and I just don't see this West Virginia team catching Kansas, which means remarkably in what you could very well claim to be the toughest Big 12 ever, of course. Yeah, I mean, Kansas, if they win tomorrow night, they're going to win the, you know, sole possession or share of first place in the Big 12 regular season for the 11th straight year. I'm just continually awed by that. I really believe I will, you know, never see in any conference this duplicated again.
Ever again. like no exaggeration. Mm-hmm. Will anybody in a power conference ever win 11 state conference titles again? I say no.
No. It won't happen. It won't happen in any conference
ever again.
The tiny conferences, like Gonzaga, doesn't even get to do this. Like it's.
Really ridiculous. I think I could envision a scenario where Gonzaga could do it, but I mean, like in a power conference, I don't think this will ever happen again.
No,
crazy.
No, and I'm even someone that like I wasn't sold on this Kansas team. I was probably lower on them for longer than either of you guys were, at least, and probably like generally the journalist community, I was lower on them than anyone, and I still just like I'm sold on them now. They're an incredible team. They're just awesome. Frank Mason has been one of the most improved players in the country. Kelly Oubre is coming on. I still don't understand what's going on with Cliff Alexander, but whatever. They're just a really good team. They defend pretty well compared to, it's not like the same Bill Self team that he's had in the past defensively, but they're starting to really get down and defend well. The offense is good. It's just a really, really impressive job that Bill Self's done.
No, it's been a tremendous coaching job. I mean, I know that he's got a Kelly Oubre and he's got Cliff Alexander Perry. He's got players, right? I mean, he's Bill Self. He coaches the Kansas. He's going to have players. But from where this team was early, how about this? When you start with a team and you don't even know who your players ought to be, you don't even know what your rotations are, you are really learning on the fly. Like, you had to figure it out on the fly. Now, again, it's easier to figure it out when you've got really talented dudes. But still, if you ask Bill, you talk to Bill Self in the preseason and say, okay, walk me through your rotations. Who's going to be your most important players? He might have had an idea. It has all changed. Everything about that team has changed.
Yep.
From November to February 1st, and that's coaching. That's all you ask college basketball coaches to do is enroll as talented guys as you can, and then like develop them into a team. Like it's sort of a cliche. People say teams get better throughout. Teams always get better. No, teams don't always get better, and some actually get worse. And this is a Kansas team that is actually getting better, noticeably and tangibly better, and it's been a hell of a coaching job. We hear all the time about, should John Calipari be National Coach of the Year, Tony Bennett. And how could I argue against either one of those guys? But Bill deserves to be in that conversation as well. What he's doing.
One seed.
Yeah.
If they win this, I don't remember if you mentioned him, GP, but just to circle back and wrap up, they win this game, they will be a one seed projected. I think Palm had him as a one on Friday anyway, just because they're both traditional and tempo free. RPI, they're number one. Right. KenPom, they're number one strength of schedule. So there's little doubt about it. If they were to beat Iowa State, they'd be, as long as they won the Big 12 and dodged any like crazy losses, they'll probably be in a good spot for a number one.
Right. All right. Well, I kept you guys here long enough, so let's get out of here. Remember, you can subscribe to the Island College Basketball Podcast on iTunes. It's the quickest way to get your hands on the latest podcast, so make sure to do that. And also, a bit of a note, if you care, we're going to start doing Monday, Wednesday, Friday podcasts. So we've been doing basically Monday morning and Friday morning. We're now going to try to do Monday, Wednesday, and Friday as often as possible. You know what? I won't even qualify. We're going to do Monday, Wednesday, Friday, one way or another. So check back with us Wednesday. Until then, take care.